Hello, and welcome to Kinder Conversations live at 180 House. I'm Catherine.
And I'm Robin. We're the co-founders of Kinda, the women-led neuroaesthetic studio. We work as a bridge between academia and the creative industries, translating insight into creative projects to help art, culture, and technology work harder for people's well-being.
In this series, recorded at 180 House, we have been hosting informal conversations about the rise of neuroaesthetics, the exciting space at the intersection of neuroscience and the arts.
Across six episodes, we're exploring connection and immersion in our daily worlds through interdisciplinary conversations. Each session considers a provocation, asking us to consider new design paradigms through the lens of neuroscience. How can we better use scientific insight to fuel creativity and build experiences with greater meaning and impact?
To answer these questions and more, we're joined by a range of incredible guests from the worlds of art, sound, neuroscience, and of course, yourself. In this episode, Robin will be discussing the power of immersive experiences and how to incorporate a science-informed design practice into your own creative work. Robin is joined by May Abdallah, Executive Director of the immersive studio Anagram, an expert in thought-provoking interactive storytelling and immersive experience design. So, let's head into the conversation.
We'd love to hear from you, May, about kind of the whole ethos of Anagram and what you hope, what you achieve through your work and how you kind of bring people into stories.
So I set up Anagram 10 years ago this month, in fact. Happy birthday to me.
Happy birthday.
And what the kind of dream or the vision was at the beginning was very much I'd been working in film and was really excited by technology, and kind of the question that began the journey that is now the studio was, can the body be part of the story? Can we do interaction in a way that doesn't break immersion? So, you know, I love cinema. I love the experience of committing those 90 minutes in on a soft plush chair, completely in a world. And anytime I'd done an immersive experience or anything that involved interaction, I felt like it didn't ask the same amount from me. I didn't really travel into that place where I could kind of break myself down and reconfigure myself like a, you know, a caterpillar becoming a butterfly. So it was this kind of insanely high ambition of, could we do interaction without breaking experience? And that has kind of, you know, whichever medium we use, whether that's installation, VR, AR, that's kind of the key thing, which is the sweetness of the journey and how deep someone can travel with you. And so the first experience we made 10 years ago was a 6,000 square foot blindfolded journey called Door into the Dark, which was about the meaning of feeling lost and kind of lost as a paradigm for thinking about our own journey into the unknown. And I think partly, you know, I started in documentary and I was just interested in kind of flipping the subject matter. So the subject was ultimately you and your ability in that journey to kind of, you know, you didn't have to share, you didn't have to tell anybody, you didn't have to like record your voice and say when was the last time you were lost, but just an opportunity which was spacious and kind of flexible enough that different people with their different memories and different associations could find their own personal relationship with what does it mean to not know what the next step is. You spend the first 9 minutes following a rope and then the rope stops in midair and you have to step forward into the dark. And even though, you know, you assume that no one's built a giant hole and you've been told that, you know, the insurance is all covered, you know, the kind of level of physical experience and anxiety, not that anxiety is always a wonderful thing to bring, for some excitement, for others anxiety, becomes like this palpable thing that everybody feels in that moment. And that becomes almost the medium through which the rest of the story happens, because we all knew exactly what we felt in that moment. So that's kind of been the principle and like maybe the obsession. And what I think is really interesting, and maybe kind of, we were just talking about, you know, Goliath's been successful in many ways, and not just kind of with accolades, but it's a VR experience about mental health and psychosis. So it's very much in the niche end of the spectrum of what people with VR headsets want to be doing. And we really kind of assumed that we would get really bad reviews because, you know, it's not a game, you know, it's an experience. And the very first review actually was a 1-star review saying, this is not a game, it's a story. But then subsequently, the community of people, I mean, lots of them are gamers, but then obviously gaming is a gigantic term. Most people are gamers now. But just kind of really stood up and defended the experience. And it became, you know, within the comments thread and online and on like Reddit and Discord and loads of different places, people became really interested in writing quite long reviews about their own experience with mental health and isolation. And I think kind of we had this question around what's shifting in terms of what kind of cultural experiences we can be making. Because, you know, our first VR experience was in 2017. And something that I think is very tangible and as creators is that, you know, the palette of colors that you can paint with is constantly evolving. You know, if with interactive work, if the audience don't know what to do, you kind of don't have a story. So the more that, and it's something that's always mystified me, which is like, you know, there's a definitely like an increase in complexity in terms of virtual reality. And it's very much like if you think about cinema 100 years ago and to think in terms of the kinds of shots that people could use. And now, you know, the edits, the speeds of the edits, the kind of intelligence that you can assume the audience have, like if the shot is just 1 second too long, you know, this must mean that something is awry in the neighborhood. Or if there's a cutaway to the bag, you know, oh, she's going to leave him tomorrow. And you've got this real dictionary of experience. And then kind of simultaneously, we've got this non-visual dictionary of experience that's emerging in immersive storytelling. And, you know, this is something that we were talking about in terms of like when you were talking about Soma aesthetics, which is, you know, and it's an interesting question is like, are people changing or is the language changing? How much can sensation be genuinely part of storytelling? And I think this is kind of the question that has been really fascinating. Because another thing, and I don't know how much VR people have done, which is really only at the kind of tip of that. You know, for example, there's a scene in Goliath, which for a lot of people, it's a little bit unnerving. And people talk about it. And, you know, I know that part of the reason that they find it unnerving is that the floor is shrinking while they're in that scene. But nobody necessarily notices the floor is shrinking. It's a little bit like, it's not something you may visually experience. It's just something that gives you this sensation without you necessarily. And it's the same with, you know, you can place objects behind you in VR and sounds behind you. And so you're reading this kind of tapestry of information, not kind of, let's say, with your mind, but really with your body. And I think I'll pause there for your next question.
I have so many questions. You've touched on so many things that I want to explore. I'm going to try and go in some sort of sequence because there's so much that you've said. So May touched on, you know, quite a big aspect of VR and also quite a big aspect of the work at Kinda Studios and what we're interested in regards to our senses and leading with our body. And ultimately, VR and immersive experiences is really interesting because it's about the perception we have within the spaces that we inhabit. You know, it works on our perceptual brain that, you know, associates our relationship to the objects and the events within the spaces in the experience. And then our body and brain respond in turn. So our physiological body responds by giving us kind of emotional signals and markers of arousal. Our cognitive brain only then catches up later that rationally this isn't real, but it's too late because our body, you know, has already kind of responded in time. And so all of those are based on the senses that we're kind of bringing in through the experience, and that allows us to really embody ourselves in something new. And so whether that's experiencing ourselves in a new way, like some VR work does in regards to embodiment or embodying a new character, building relationships to yourself, you know, a lot of May's work is building relationship to others. And this is really, you know, a key aspect of how do we transport people into a story. And so May touched on kind of some tools that they use to both make people feel uncomfortable and comfortable and really recognizing things within somebody else. And so this notion of kind of empathy, or for example, is really, you know, crucial in all storytelling. And it's spoken a lot about in worlds of VR, especially because it really allows you to really put yourself in someone else's shoes. But it's really interesting in terms of this transportation, because ultimately being transported somewhere is really what leads to kind of that transformative impact and releases all these sort of neurochemicals in our brains and our bodies to really get us there in terms of even the oxytocin of connecting with individuals or characters. And so maybe you can tell us about some of the tools you use to really ground somebody into that space, mm-hmm. both maybe in the way of how you do the storytelling narrative, to also communicate what are some pretty challenging things to discuss. You know, I think what's really interesting about Goliath is that, you know, if you heard a story of a schizophrenic person, it would be maybe a bit hard to identify with and hard to kind of even pay attention to in some ways, because the relatability is perhaps not there for a lot of us. And so how you really kind of ground someone into that experience that allows us to open our perceptual field more to what this person is going through.
Mm-hmm. So I think I should preface that, you know, the objective of all the experiences, really, you know, Anagram has this kind of quite a clear social political bent in terms of why and how we make things or what we're trying to achieve. And when we set out to make Goliath, and honestly, we had thought, you know, we shouldn't make any VR. It's very expensive and time consuming. It's not very good. But we kind of thought, okay, well, let's think about, you know, now that we're really getting, you've invested a lot of time into kind of working out this process and this pipeline and all of the difficult things about trying to work with the actual new technologies that don't have all of this stuff worked out for you in advance. The question to us had been, you know, well, what's a really good story to tell with this headset? Like, why would you choose this? And then, so Barry, who's the co-director, he kind of was talking, he kind of recalled a story that he'd heard through a friend, which was the story of this particular individual whose name is John, but known as Goliath online, which was about, you know, that he'd been diagnosed as schizophrenia. He'd been in hospital for 10 years. He'd been very isolated when he came out. And then he had this kind of new persona online. And this question of like trying to tell the story of what psychosis is using virtual reality, you kind of relating that experience of something isn't real, but it feels real, that people find challenging, right? You know, so schizophrenia is the most stigmatized of all mental health conditions. It's repeatedly kind of used as the trope in horror movies, as kind of, you know, there's a lot of stigma and prejudice towards people with who experience psychosis, and that really, you know, that affects them. And it felt like, well, you know, if we can try and bridge that experiential gap so that when people see somebody in the street, they kind of have this momentary recollection of what's happening on the inside. You know, how could you use like a VR headset almost as a kind of like a way of just diving into someone's reality? So that was very much, you know, so we were really clear about that. So every single kind of design decision was just about trying to get across what felt like a vast, you know, desert of relatability. And it was interesting, like one of the first books I found about schizophrenia, which is kind of, it's about 100 years old. It was like a doctor. It's called The Autobiography of a Schizophrenic Girl. It was written in 1925. And a doctor had kind of written case notes of this girl's experience. And I'm just going to read you like a tiny section of that. But I remember feeling this alarming sense of, you know, she's... Let me read it first. So, objects are stage trappings placed here and there, geometric cubes without meaning. People turn weirdly about. They make gestures, movements without sense. They are phantoms whirling on an infinite plane crushed by the pitiless electric light. So anyone who's done VR knows that that sounds quite similar to what VR can feel like. It felt like this metaphorical connection could be built, the sense of, you know, this is something that I know, but it's also alienating. So that was very much the kind of empathetic goal. And so within VR, voiced by Tilda Swinton, there's this character who talks to you and is kind of not just kind of asking you to do things, but asking you to kind of reflect on why and how you choose to do things. And that kind of trying to, I think kind of the real goal was also not to just create a story where people feel sorry for somebody and kind of like create that sense of pity, but really that sense of, we all have those moments where we're not quite sure what's in our peripheral vision and we make an assumption that it's something other than it is. And what if you kind of exaggerate that feeling? And also it was important that it was ultimately a happy story and not a kind of crushingly sad story. And so it's quite jubilant in the end in terms of, you know, this kind of possibility of just moving between many realities and them all having emotional and connect, you know, they're more possibility of finding connection without within them. So to some degree, you know, it's really using a lot of things that you kind of we know from storytelling and, you know, that edit of connecting to a person's life story. So it's led by this interview with John, and John's got a lovely voice. He's got a very honest, simple way of speaking, and he's very relatable in how he kind of talks about his journey from childhood to kind of, you know, having his first psychotic episode while he was DJing in a club. And some of that, you know, that's kind of an opportunity for this, for a sense of drama. But then kind of when you're talking about like what are the design decisions, kind of want to keep almost just breaking that story that is about thinking about someone else to making sure that you're also thinking about yourself. So this is something that you experienced in Messages to a Post-Human Earth, which is how we met each other, which is the AR experience about plant intelligence, which is just trying to keep, to kind of emphasize that sense of noticing your own physical response to things. And it is quite interesting that, like, you know, in terms of wellness and meditation and mindfulness, a lot of that is just reminding people to notice.
Well, exactly. I think, you know, as I kind of spoke about at the beginning, I think overall, this is maybe a bit of a bold statement, but over the course of the past 10 years, we've actually been kind of programming into new habits of being less present. There's just so many things to distract us that perhaps we're not really realizing we're much less present in the spaces that we're in. And so, as May mentioned in Messages to a Post-Human Earth, which is this, you know, AR-led experience where you're interacting with another person in the experience. It's a two-player experience. And you're continually asked to move around outside. At one point, you're asked to kind of pick up objects and collect them. And it's this notion of immersion where, you know, your full body is in the experience. You're not only having to interact with somebody else, but you're also having to kind of interact with the game and remember that you're not the game, sorry, the experience. That you are part of it, that you're designing it, you know, and this notion of it can't exist without you and without your body.
I was just going to say one thing on that, which is, I think, because your initial question was how do you use the technology? And I think the very first thing that we thought about actually when we started Anagram was that really the body is the technology. And all it is, you know, what can we do to that body? Like the buttons, everybody's got their buttons, you know, but we might not quite know. Some people, you can assume that one button, everybody's got that one, and then a few people have slightly distinct ones. And then really as a designer or as an artist or whatever it is you're doing, the question, and that's a much more like accessible place to start with, because there are things that you just know. You know that when someone comes around to your house, you might ask them if they'd like to sit down, or you might give them a drink of water. And I think that some of these experiences, they like really benefit from some of that kind of simple logic, whereby, like, what do you touch?
What's intuitive to you to do naturally?
Yeah, what does it feel like to hold this headset? You know, one of our experiences, the one about power dynamics, was an installation that uses VR with one person inside the headset and the other person holds the controllers and you know, everyone sees half of the experience. And well, because it was a physical installation, Goliath is something that people can do at home. But we had a lot of control over the physical sensation of that journey. And being, you know, a lot of that is just observing people. You know, it's almost like being a good host. Or a bad host if you want to freak them out. But I'm generally, freaking them out isn't something I think you shouldn't try and freak people out, because if you do, then they're not going to come with their, you know, they're not going to be open enough to feel anything. But
yeah,
I know.
But I do want to touch on that about making people feel uncomfortable. I want to go somewhere else first. Yeah. And also just note the mention of your body as a technology, because as somebody who works in the realm of neuroscience, I'm always kind of pushing the body over the brain. And I don't know if I've ever used the word your body as a technology, but it's, you know, it's really interesting because, you know, even if you think about our language, May touched on some of these things. Like, we have these metaphors where we say, like, a body of knowledge. You know, if you ever think about actually where that comes from, your body accumulates knowledge and it stores it there. It's not just kind of leading with your head. But in terms of the head and the brain, you know, you touched on something really interesting when we talk about getting into the experience of others, you know, we mentioned. And this notion of context is really important. And hearing stories of somebody else. And so our brain is actually hardwired for context. We can't really relate to things unless we have context and relevance for them. We can't actually physically understand them. There's an entire part of the brain that's kind of, you know, this coded for context in this way. And a lot of the time we, you know, in terms of mindfulness and wellness practices, people talk about gratitude. And most of the time people think about a gratitude practice as writing down your gratitude for the day and thinking about what you're specifically grateful for. But actually what a lot of the science shows is that listening to an experience of somebody else where they may have received gratitude or been in gratitude of something is actually more beneficial for our well-being. And so ultimately, Goliath is about connection, somebody who finds connection with others, you know, who's isolated and has these multiplayer interactive experiences. And you guys will all have a chance to experience it very soon. But ultimately, you are experiencing somebody else's story of how they found connection. And what this does to our body, and the reason it's more powerful, is because it creates this physiological change. You know, when we hear stories of others, our heart rate starts to accelerate, it starts to drop, we have this oxytocin release, these other neurochemicals. And it's through these physiological changes in our body that gets us to really feel something. And that experience within our body of feeling that change is more powerful than just being able to listen and rationally understand something. And so I really love this idea of what you said about kind of thinking about the body first and how you can make people step out of their comfort zone to really kind of experience some of those impacts that, you know, the characters experience themselves.
Yeah, I think the goal is definitely to get people out of their comfort zone, but it is definitely a journey. So, and I think having a narrative storytelling background through film is really helpful, because you know that you kind of have to earn that kind of ending. You have to, well, it's not the ending. Normally you put the hard bit kind of around 2/3 of your narrative, because you have to, it has to feel playful. It has to feel compelling enough for people to follow, for them to basically be able to trust to do that kind of stepping of out of the comfort zone. And I think kind of what, so now we're making a new experience, which is actually about ADHD, called Impulse. And
great name.
Thanks. I mean, I'm learning so much, and it's very, you know, it's very exciting to think about how you can kind of simultaneously play with people's brain and also show them what you're doing. Because, you know, we all, I think there's a combination of like self-understanding as well, which is also very satisfying, because there's a sense in which we're quite alienated from ourselves. And while with schizophrenia, you know, perhaps for people, they know somebody with the condition, but they might not experience it themselves. And, you know, I have lots of issues with the term ADHD, but it's a really interesting kind of starting point to think about how we respond to to input, because that's all really that it is.
Well, it's like when we think about this topic of distraction, it's really at the heart of it, right? I'm learning a lot about ADHD, you know, and how we probably all exist, you know, on a spectrum of what it entails. And so I can imagine the relatability is quite high in regards to the notion of impulse and the distracted nature of things.
Yeah, and I think it's very much just about starting kind of like, how do we process information? How do each of us as individuals kind of make a composite sense of where we are and what we're doing? And you know, similarly, the goal is to try and empathize and kind of connect to people whose behavior might be problematic or difficult and, you know, bridge that gap of understanding so that we kind of start from a position of like, you have a good sense of what that sensation is and you can make intuitive decisions about what someone might need. You know, because fundamentally, you know, we are trying to kind of bridge this sense of what would it be if we, how do we get to like a more compassionate society where like difference doesn't become like, you know, this very triggering topic that it is at the moment.
I think it's really interesting because I think part of how do we get to a society where, you know, difference is minimized, it ultimately all comes back to ourselves, right? We're only responsible for ourselves and the way that we exist in the world. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about is how we can update our experiences of understanding what multiple things mean. And I think when it comes to placing people in environments and experiences where they feel both a sense of comfort and discomfort, and that journey of taking somebody to an uncomfortable feeling is really important. Because a lot of the times we disconnect from these uncomfortable feelings, or if we can't relate to it, we switch off from it automatically for multiple reasons. And the more that we can have experiences, the more we can have experiences of our own body, update our understanding what these signals mean, the more we can have a broader definition of our own emotional experience, but also the emotional experiences of others. So we would have spoken about this in our very first session when we talked about interoception, which is your ability to feel your internal bodily sensations, your ability to recognize your heartbeat, to recognize your hunger, your thirst. Ultimately, it's related to your intuition, being able to connect to your own decision making. But what's interesting is the more you can connect to your own physiological body, the more you can connect to others. So the more I can actually empathize and feel into you. And one of the things, one of the interventions, if you will, for interoception is called exposure therapy, which is basically you expose somebody to various experiences to update their sensation, their Rolodex, if you will, of what these sensations mean. And I've seen this also kind of come up in VR experience as well, exposing somebody to more experiences that they wouldn't have wanted to place them in, but ultimately you're placing them in like a safe container where they have the safety to experience them. And this is ultimately related kind of to something we really love to tout called aesthetic emotions. You know, when you listen to a sad piece of music or when you watch a scary film, you can experience the emotions of fear and you can experience the emotions of sadness more easily because it doesn't belong to you. There's this psychological distance of knowing it's not actually mine, but through the experience of listening to that sad song, I'm processing my own sadness, whether you're aware of it or not. Your body and your brain are changing and it's updating your understanding of what these things mean. And so when you're placing people in experiences where, you know, the floor is getting smaller or, you know, you're starting to feel the discomfort that somebody else would feel, for me, this is really important aspect of updating our understanding of experiences of the world. And whether you're conscious it's happening or not, these body-based changes are leading to greater understanding.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I didn't know all those things. And I think it's interesting to think about endings in that light. You know, where do you leave somebody? Where do you kind of, because if it ended at that moment when the floor was shrinking, but you didn't know, there's something kind of careless about that experience. It kind of doesn't look after the audience member. And that's kind of, it's maybe like it's an instinctual sense in terms of how we leave things, where you want to kind of have gone to the edge of discomfort and kind of like stayed with it and kind of maybe processed it for yourself or people you know or something that you can't cognitively just think about. And I actually, our experience that was at the Imperial War Museum about refugees was really interesting because it really felt that people did want to think about the refugee crisis in a way that like journalism doesn't help us think about it. It doesn't necessarily help us understand like what do we do with this information and this sense of that there are borders and that people are traveling and we don't know where we fit within that narrative. And, you know, as opposed to kind of this immediately start with this kind of binary sense of like what's good and bad, which is very alienating. And we were trying to find like once again, this kind of somatic journey where like, this is a subject that I don't think we can think about using words. I know that's a little bit radical, but you know, partly, and I think we're not quite there yet, you know, when you see Goliath, there's a lot of words in it, but I think what's exciting is to kind of see how like few words we need to be able to also kind of understand that whole tapestry of like an emotional arc. I mean, you still need words, I think, but like that there's something that can, you also feel like you've processed it and you do feel like you know more, but not necessarily because some expert has told you what the right answer to this extremely complex thing is. And I think there's, we have a lot of like complex subjects that we do want to figure out how to get closer to an understanding, and we're not given a lot of guidance on how we're supposed to do those things.
Music to my ears. We speak a lot about this notion of kind of muscular bonding and nonverbal connection. You know, we have these a lot in of our collective experiences whenever you're dancing in a group of people. You know, we always like to talk about at a music festival or at a gig, you walk into a room of strangers and you leave kind of like this bonded group of friends, really. You've had the experience where you make friends with someone on a dance floor without ever speaking to them. And so there's so much to be held within these visceral experiences of the body and having these shared experiences and knowing that our body is really a tool for learning. Something that kind of struck me when you were speaking about this notion of experiencing through the body, this notion of listening. I was even just listening to a podcast. this is actually the question. How we listen, like allowing us to learn how to experience differently. And literally on the way here, I was cycling and listening to a podcast about, we all need to be trained how to listen, you know, like bodybuilders get trained to lift more weight. Maybe we think that we all know how to listen coming out of the womb, but we're all kind of programmed and we need to learn how to listen differently. And I think that these experiences do allow us to do so. I was wondering, we're talking about immersion, like this whole series is about immersion, and today is really about immersion, how to get there and presence and how to use it kind of as tools for change. And so I know that Goliath recently was reformatted for an immersive space, not in a VR landscape in Montreal, right? And I was just wondering, in terms of, you know, and you've created experiences in multiple sort of settings, not only VR based, because obviously VR is limiting to some degree in regards to the technology. I was wondering, yeah, what your perspective was about that sense of immersion and how Goliath landed in that kind of more 360 immersive space. You know, I haven't even really mentioned it, but obviously we're at 180 The Strand today, which is, you know, one of the kind of, you know, landmark experience places in London, if not in Europe. And we've all seen these amazing 360 media walls and they're popping up more and more. But what's the experience within VR or versus kind of these large new media spaces?
Okay, yeah, it's a great question. So it's the word immersion is being used a lot in every part of everybody's everything. And so I think you kind of have to start kind of defining a few of your own principles about what you are going to accept as immersion. This is a very immersive room, guys, don't you think? There's light, there's sound. Can you hear Robin pouring her water? And it's okay, you know, like the hype might benefit some of us in the long term. But I think you kind of, you know, as creatives, I'm assuming you all have really cool glasses, so I think most of you must be creatives. But we kind of have to maintain our critical faculties when it comes to like what we think we're doing and why. And so that's kind of just you said. Meanwhile, we have made an immersive experience in Montreal. And I think it's a whole different kind of design problem. I actually recently went to an immersive experience at the Grand Palais in Paris, and it had a very different kind. I'm really a fan of corridors and narrative arcs and, preparing people. And some spaces, because of whatever flow, financing, they can't necessarily do that. But you kind of always want a beginning to how that journey begins. And sometimes when you walk into space and it's just one screen and it's on a loop and maybe you were there at the beginning or not, it doesn't necessarily mean it's broken because there's a loop, but it's more a sense of like, how do you transition? You can just assume that people have come kind of from the cold outdoors and they're not really ready to listen. And 100%. And actually there's lots of interesting and small tricks to be able to do that. But I think there's kind of a responsibility to like, I mean, James Turrell is like the master at this. He's such a bully when it comes to how you should experience his experiences. And so like, but ultimately you're like, I'm really glad no one can use a phone here. Thank you. And that kind of the antechamber is probably like the most important place. I mean, I'd say the offboarding room is also really important. We kind of always like, it was interesting for us because Goliath was going to be an installation. COVID happened. It became something that people could download in their homes. It was a great result for us because it meant like millions of people could see it. But at the same time, you know, at Anagram, we're control freaks, like 100%. We kind of want people to pay attention and we want to we want to win their attention, but we also want to kind of, like you said, like it will be better for you in the long term, guys. Just listen to us. And so some of the things like initially in Door Into the Dark, the very first room that you go into, it was kind of, there was a locker room. You don't just go straight into the darkness and hold the rope. You're told to wait for the person who is finishing to come out. And then they tell you that they have a key to a locker. You have to put your shoes, taking shoes off is often a classic, you know, take your shoes off and your bag and put it in a locker and then you begin. So you have this moment of kind of like waiting in silence and like taking things away. And it just so happened, I'm going to kind of give away a secret here, but when you returned to the room at the end and you had the key and you took your bag and you took your shoes out of the locker and then and you kind of told the next person to do, you kind of did the same thing that had been done to you. You opened the door and actually you weren't in the same place you started. There were just two identical rooms and the lockers got moved throughout the experience. But it was that sense of kind of, you know, trying to make sure that nothing was kind of, when people think things are finished, you kind of want to be able to kind of continue that feeling. So, you know, inevitably, like, okay, that was interesting. I spent 45 minutes in the dark. I thought about some stuff. Let me get my phone out and put it back on. I'm late for dinner. But just that kind of ending of like something happened beyond the last door was just a way of saying like, you know, now you're lost because you don't know where you are. And that's actually what we're talking about. And so some of those, you know, you've got these very big, they're particular business models, these immersive places, you know, they're looking really at throughput. But that doesn't mean that some of these kind of design thoughts can't kind of be structured into that journey. But sometimes they're not very well held and kind of finished because they have other motivations.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of the time you're seeing a multi-artist installation, so you're just seeing one room from one artist, and they don't necessarily all link together, and they're beautiful spectacles, but they're not necessarily transporting you through a story. You've touched on some other things that are particularly love in regards to kind of experience setting, and it kind of goes back to context. We talk about this a lot when it comes to, I mean, we often talk about it as it lends from psychedelic experiences, but it's not really just that. It's just like in psychedelic journeys or psychedelic therapy, like the preparation as well as the integration is really important. And you touched on this aspect of when somebody leaves a very busy environment, especially streets of London, traffic, noise pollution, noise on your phone, somebody bothering you, you know, a stress that you bring in. It's really hard to get rid of that stress and enter the space and fully. So how do you kind of prepare somebody for the experience or prime them to have the best experience they can have, which ultimately it sounds like strict and stringent rules of how to experience is the winner. If people are open to that.
You can also use surprise and playfulness and silliness. You just have to kind of find a way to, you know, Punch Drunk do it with throwing you out of the lift at different places so you lose your friends. But they were kind of, when I think about people who like to use fear as a way to open people versus, I love Punch Drunk, but we've often had conversations about fear as a motivator. I think I'm interested in finding ways that don't involve fear to do that.
100%.
That kind of warmth, that kind of joyfulness or like intrigue or tenderness or other things.
The surprise and delight that will change your emotional state, change your arousal. We do need to wrap, but I think that, you know, as as you kind of heard, there's so many messages to take away, and I hope that everybody took away something for their own personal, creative, professional experience. But ultimately, I think what's really exciting is how many different ways we can use immersive technologies. It's not just about this kind of entertaining aspect, and the work that May is doing with her whole amazing team at Anagram is really setting the stage for how much social impact we can have from these experiences. And I think if there's one thing I'd like everyone to take away from this today, it's that while technology is profound, as May said earlier, our own personal technology sits within our body, which we walk around with every single day. And so we are immersed in our aesthetic, immersive environments everywhere we go. And so when we talk about immersion, presence, empathy, embodying yourself, embodying others, we actually have the ability to do this in every moment of our lives. And it's wonderful to have tools like technology to remind us how to do it. But if you can just go about your day today a little bit differently, thinking about how you can be a little bit more present in the environments that you are in, that would be the kind of takeaway message for today. Thanks so much for coming. Thanks.
Thank you to our guest, May Abdallah, for providing her insight onto how to create both engaging and powerful experiences that can drive important perspective and crucially change our behaviors. And of course, thank you to 180 House for hosting our session. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Kinda Conversations. You can find out more about the work of our studio and sign up to our newsletter at kindastudios.com.
If you've enjoyed this, please share. And of course, please subscribe so you know when more episodes are released. We also like ratings and comments too.
See you next time.